My fellow plebs, River is setting a new standard in Bitcoin. At river.com, you'll pay zero fees when you dollar cost average. Truly the best way to build your Bitcoin wealth. All Bitcoin at River is held in secure cold storage with 100% full reserves. There's no need to wonder what's happening behind the scenes. Your Bitcoin is your Bitcoin to withdraw at any time. Additionally, River lets you make Bitcoin payments via the Lightning Network, offers a Lightning integration for developers, and allows you to mine Bitcoin directly to your River account. River has a level of service that is unheard of in this industry, including phone support, private client advisors, and the ability to designate beneficiaries to inherit your Bitcoin wealth. River has become the premium name in Bitcoin that anyone can easily access. Sure, you have a place to buy Bitcoin, but have you tried River? See and feel the difference at river.com and the River iOS app, the preferred partner of Bitcoin Magazine. Over the last 5 years, the Bitcoin Conference has become the world's largest gathering of Bitcoiners. From breaking announcements and international media coverage to countless meaningful talks by thought leaders and industry innovators, we are excited to continue our drive for global hyper-Bitcoinization. From July 25th to the 27th, 2024, we'll be taking the Bitcoin Conference to the city of music and freedom, Nashville, Tennessee. Join thousands of attendees for countless opportunities to learn, engage, and network across 3 days of pure Bitcoin signal. Get your tickets now for the best price at b.tc/conference. You are not going to want to miss what Nashville has in store.
Bitcoiners, welcome back to another episode of the Bitcoin Magazine podcast. It is your host, CK, and this week I have a really awesome podcast. I am the first person to get Stephen Pollock, head of growth and strategy at BPI, the Bitcoin Policy Institute, on a podcast. This is going to be a first ever interview. Stephen is awesome. I met him a couple years back. We've been working very closely together, and he has done an incredible job moving things forward for probably the only institution out there that's putting out really good peer-reviewed content with a Bitcoin focus and putting it in front of regulators so that way they can at least try to be informed. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, CK. Man, it's exciting to get to just sit down and talk about this story with you a little bit. I know, you know, you guys are good friends of ours. CK's, you know, you've been a great friend of BPI for a long time and now mine personally. So it's been a pleasure to get to know you and get to know the rest of the team there at Bitcoin Magazine.
Yeah, well, hey, Stephen, you know, I've been a huge advocate of BPI pretty much since the beginning. David and Grant are, you know, close friends and people, you know, that I would consider to be counterparts in this Bitcoin movement. And then, you know, getting to meet you and seeing you join the BPI team and the awesome work that you were able to do in moving that project forward, it's just been really awesome. And, you know, I'm happy to call you a friend and excited to have you on the show. So I guess really quick, Stephen, why don't you just like introduce people to who you are? How did you get into Bitcoin? Why are you on BPI? How did you get in this position? So I know there's a lot of questions. Let's just talk about your story.
Sure. Well, like most people listening to this podcast, you know, this episode, others, you know, I'm pretty similar. I have a similar story to most people. It's a little bit chaotic of how I got into Bitcoin to begin with, and you know, sort of transitioned over to working in the industry in a professional capacity. So I started fooling around with Bitcoin in 2016, 2017. I thought it was super interesting for obvious reasons. Started going down the rabbit hole, the podcast loop, and got to know a handful of people through Twitter and you know, whatnot, just trying to learn and grow in my, you know, in my Bitcoin journey there. Along, you know, the same time, and really for about a decade, my career was primarily focused in the political realm. And I use that blanket term because, you know, I did a little bit of everything. I started out just after college running state campaigns, local campaigns, counties. I knocked 10,000 doors, you know, in the summers and just sort of wore through different pairs of walking shoes, you know, working on issues and working on candidate campaigns. Through that, I, you know, kind of developed a passion for it, got to meet a lot of really cool people in Missouri, where I'm originally from, and you know, started moving up through the ranks and working on non-candidate campaigns, and working in over 40 plus states for different types of issues. So you've kind of got, there's issue campaigns, there's candidate campaigns. And with an issue, it may be more grassroots, or it may be, hey, we're upside down in the polls in these 7 congressional districts across the country. So we're going to send different teams to do different types of events, or, you know, softer type of influence campaigns. It sounds super, super shady, but, you know, I really enjoyed it. I always was working on things that I personally agreed with. And so I think that's becoming increasingly rare in the political world, unfortunately. But yeah.
Background.
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't mean to interrupt, but, you know, like, in terms of your role at the Bitcoin Policy Institute and the issue of Bitcoin in America and Bitcoin being good for America, and there being a massive asymmetry in understanding that, and then kind of all the other narratives that are out there. You know, I can't think of a better person to, you know, someone with a better background to kind of be on that forefront, because, like, it's a contact sport. Let's be real. And you got to get out in the field, and you got to shake hands, you got to meet people, and you got to, you know, look them in the eye and tell them what you believe, right? And that's how you change hearts and minds. So the fact that you kind of had that history is super unique.
I think I appreciate you saying that. You know, it takes all types. So, you know, before we kind of pick up where we left off, I just want to say, as far as Bitcoin Policy Institute is concerned, I've been here, you know, a little while now, and got to know some of the guys. Obviously, Grant McCarty and David Zell, co-founders of BPI, extremely sharp individuals, high integrity, and a couple of the, you know, hardest hustlers I've seen. And I've seen a lot of different, you know, types under that political umbrella. And we're a nonprofit. And I think sometimes, you know, you think of a nonprofit, you're like, okay, what exactly, how do you guys approach things? And I think we can get into that a little bit, I think it all starts at the top with any organization, and those guys are, you know, hustling it and busting it every day. And that was part of the reason I was attracted to this, because when you're in full campaign mode, which I was off and on for about 10 years, you start to learn, like, when it's time to flip the switch and it's time to go. And that's where we're at as an industry in the Bitcoin world. I mean, you guys get this. You're in full campaign mode every day, whether it's, you know, producing magazines and delivering good, reliable information to people, or whether it's the Bitcoin conference. And as soon as you're done with one, or probably months before you're done with the conference, you're already planning the next thing. You're already having to get speakers ready, because the content is evolving so rapidly. The landscape is evolving so rapidly. And so we have to be on that cutting edge, or else we're irrelevant. And there's you know, there's bills in DC that are being passed every day or trying to be passed. There's regulatory agencies that are discussing these things, Bitcoin and other digital currencies, every day. The SEC is doing whatever they do, right? And him hawing around, or, you know, whatever your opinion is on that, we have to stay on top of it. And so that's what's attractive to me about working in an industry. One, I'm a Bitcoiner, and I think Bitcoin's one of the most, like, unbelievable inventions in our lifetimes. I think it's super powerful, and the freedom implications of it obviously are you know, unparalleled. So to kind of circle back on my journey, I ended up bumping into some people at a Bitcoin meetup, and you know, I know I'm based in Nashville, Tennessee. BPI is based in Washington, D.C. Let's go. And I've been here, you know, for quite a while. My family's here. I wasn't going anywhere, and I ended up.
That's how we got to meet.
Right. I know. We met through the meetup, and, you know, we were talking. I think we were getting coffee. I got coffee with you and some other friends. And to be honest, I didn't want to tell you guys. I don't know if I've ever told you this. I didn't want to tell anyone I worked. My background was in politics, because I just assumed Bitcoiners would, like, not want to hang out with me. And I was like, man, I don't know any other, you know, Bitcoiners. Like, these are my guys. And so we ended up talking a little more, And I think I remember a few, you're like, have you met BPI? Like, have you met the guys at BPI? And I was like, I don't really know what you're talking about. And fast forward a few months and I'm working here.
Yeah, well, I even want to, so I vividly remember that. And I remember, you know, Odell, yourself, me, we were hanging out at Bitcoin Park. And it, like, we were kind of like trying to, you know, pry information out of you. And then when it turned out like, hey, you know a thing or two about, you know, how to move the needle in the political sphere. You know, we at least thought that you needed to talk to those guys, maybe give them some advice. You know, little did we know that, you know, you're going to be, you know, one of the key people in, you know, making them sustainable, which is definitely something we want to talk about. But I want to take a step back and say, you know, Steven, you're in the political sphere. You know, you're starting to poke around and meet Bitcoiners. How did you get into Bitcoin? What about Bitcoin gets you excited? Why are you passionate about this industry?
Oh man, so many reasons. I think one, and these aren't in any particular order, as far as like working in the space, set, you know, Bitcoin itself and the societal implications of Bitcoin just to the side for a second. There's just a lot of really incredible people. They're, you know, with the work that we're talking about doing, and that we're, you know, as BPI, that we're chipping away at every day. We're not the only ones doing it. I mean, CK, people like you and a lot of our friends are doing everything they can and using their skill set to do, you know, to push this thing up the hill. But there's just a, there's a genuineness, there's a sincerity. And I would say like a sincerity of passion almost that I think is really attractive to me. These are the people that I want to and can stand shoulder to shoulder with and battle every day. And I think sometimes we, maybe if you've been in the Bitcoin universe for a little while, we kind of start to take that for granted. I don't, because I haven't been, but now that I have been in, you know, and working shoulder to shoulder with you guys and a lot of others, I'm blown away by the quality of people that are in the space. And so that's a really important thing to me. You go to conferences, you go to meetups, you go to like some of the smaller events, like at Bitcoin Park here in Nashville. Rod and Matt are crushing it there. They have some unbelievable events and opportunities there. You go there, you're just like, these are very serious people, but they're very, you know, kind. They're willing to help educate someone like me who, you know, is a little bit of an outsider, and I know some things, but there's, my specialty is different than someone else's, and we're all collaborating together. So that's one thing. And then obviously what you guys spend most of your time on the podcast talking about is just the uniqueness of Bitcoin, the decentralized nature of Bitcoin, the potential for, and this is sort of what we focus on at BPI, is like the potential for Bitcoin solving a lot of the issues that we're seeing nationally, internationally for human rights.
Yes.
You know, we do a lot of research and advocacy around that. Alex Gladstein came to our summit and blew people's minds just this last April on the Bitcoin and Human Rights panel. And part of it was that, you know, Bitcoin is a solution and is currently a solution. We're not talking 10 years from now. We're talking about right now, the way Bitcoin is making people's lives easier and in many cases saving lives, which is, you're like, what? And I think a lot of our audience in DC, and I know we're kind of all over the map here, but we did this summit last spring. And the idea was people who are in DC that may not be familiar with Bitcoin, but they know they're on maybe a human rights NGO, a non-government organization, or looking at some sort of regulation. They come to DC, they come to our summit. We have human rights experts there. And so one, they may not even know the problem. So they don't know some of these international issues that people like HRF are addressing. And so they hear the problem for the first time, and then they're hearing the solution. And I've got a great story about that we can dig into later. But that's sort of one application. There's the future of money application. I think one of the more compelling use cases of Bitcoin is within the context of national security, and that's something that we can unpack further as well. But that's something that we as a think tank and advocacy organization here at BPI are going to be focusing on, focusing a significant amount of energy and resources on over the next calendar year.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, so there's the humanitarian element, which is, you know, Alex is probably the best at articulating that. It's awesome to see that BPI is also doing a lot of good work on that front, because I think that that's undeniable. It's undeniable. There's this meme, you know, Roger Ver saying Bitcoin, you know, if you're not increasing the block size, you're killing babies. There's that much at stake. That meme is kind of hilarious because to some degree, like he is correct. There's that much at stake, but obviously it's hilarious that we're saving lives with Bitcoin. On the flip side though, you know, talking about when you talk to regulators in the United States, you know, their quote unquote number one objective is what's best for Americans and what's best for their specific constituents. Bitcoin being a part of what's best for Americans in America as a country, you know, that's something that they may or may not believe. Maybe they adamantly are against that idea. You know, how do you articulate why Bitcoin fits into what is best for Americans?
Sure. I've got some great stories along those lines. As I answer that, I want to anyone who's listening, not familiar with BPI, I kind of want to fill everyone in so that to kind of paint the broader picture the answer to the question there. So Bitcoin Policy Institute is a 501c3. So that means we're a nonprofit, which means we're not lobbyists, right? It means more than that, but it also means that I was a lobbyist for a time in my previous career. And that's a little bit different approach. In many cases, a very different approach than we've sort of chosen to take with BPI. As a nonprofit, we do research on one side, and we have about 15 fellows right now, give or take. Some are rotating on and off because they're professors, they're academics, and they're professionals with the necessary bona fides to meet the criteria that is required to sort of get past the gatekeepers in Washington, D.C. I'm trying to just put it on the dinner table here for our audience to do things like testify during congressional hearings and to hand off white papers that are, you know, 50 to 100 pages about the nature of Bitcoin in some very specific national security implication or from some very specific environmental impact or lack thereof. So that's what we do on our research side. And then on our advocacy side, we take our research or that of others. We're not picky as long as the statistics are good, as long as the research meets the very, very high bar that we set. We take it to DC, we distribute it to staffers, we have closed door meetings with elected officials. We meet on site in state with different regulatory bodies and authorities, and in some cases, elected officials. We're not really picky about how we get that data, but we are very careful about timing and appropriateness. We try to sort of be this third party as a think tank and advocacy group that we're here to help educate you. We're here to give you the resources you need. If you're a congressman and you're gung-ho and you've got Bitcoin and you think it's the best thing in the world, obviously we're here in your corner and we're here to do whatever we can to support and help. At the same time, if you're antagonistic to Bitcoin, but your team is a little curious, your staffers are like, we really don't know what we're talking about, which is a lot of people in DC especially, we have an open door policy. We're here to help educate you and bring you along and give you context via research papers that you may not have. You may not know there are very, very compelling arguments that Bitcoin doesn't harm the environment. And in fact, a mining ban would actually backfire and do more damage to the environment than whatever you claim, even if we use your basis that it currently is. So that's a little bit of like a broader context.
Thank you for that.
I would say.
Yeah, like, okay, no, I was going to say thank you for that. I went off script and I dived right into that before we even got into what BPI is. So I appreciate you talking about that. But yeah, I mean, you know, kind of now that you've given that backdrop, which is very helpful, I guess, why don't you talk about, you know, specifically the question I asked around Bitcoin being in the United States' national interest?
Sure. So I recently, I think this is a really fun story, just how these things work. You know, of course, there's the official meetings when everyone thinks, you know, you're working in DC, you got your suit and tie on, you walk into somebody's, you know, knock on a door and at a congressional office and you sit right down and hash this out. And occasionally that is how it works. More often than not, it's a little more casual than that. It's a little more building trust over time and meeting a staffer and having the conversation. Of course, Grant McCarty runs our DC office. He's running all of this. So I'm trying to kind of paint with some broad strokes here. But one example I do have was we were recently at an event and I had the opportunity. I was just introduced in passing. Like, this is an elected official, very powerful elected official out of Washington, D.C. This is his spouse. And so I found myself having a conversation for about an hour with the wife of a very high up elected official out of D.C. I'm not going to name any names or tell any tales out of school here, but it was pretty obvious she was really interested in Bitcoin. She found out what we were doing. She started asking a lot of questions and we were just kind of joking around and she kind of started telling me some stories and, hey, you know, I have, you know, her kids are, you know, teenagers and they kind of screw around with crypto and, you know, they try to tell her about, you know, they kind of told her about FTX and all these kind of things. So we're sort of highlighting the differences between Bitcoin and most of the other type of, you know, cryptocurrencies that are out there, all the other type of cryptocurrencies that are out there and the difference of, you know, that maybe like a CBDC or a digital yuan. And so that kind of started the conversation around digital yuan. You know, 30 minutes later, this really, really brilliant lady, she was talking about, well, I'll just tell you. So I told her, you know, you're very familiar with how not too long ago the U.S. fled Afghanistan. And I just asked her, you know, I said, can you imagine being, you know, someone of your age and your place in society, upper middle class, lower upper class? You don't really have a dog in this fight. You're just trying to live your life. You raise your family and move on. And basically overnight, the United States leaves. ISIS, Taliban, they're all taking over your country again. They've seized the banks. And overnight, virtually, you have lost everything you've ever owned. And she was like, yeah, she kind of talked about, you know, some stories that she had heard through her husband and different staffers about those types of scenarios. And I said, ma'am, you realize for the first time in history that woman, that her family, they can memorize 12 words and take their entire net worth, their entire life savings, walk through airport security. It can't be confiscated. You can go anywhere in the world and retrieve all of your money, everything you've ever worked for in your life. And her eyes just got, you know, like this big. And she was like, are you kidding me? And so it was funny because I talked to the staffers for the elected official later and they're like, what did you say? Like, this lady's having us order all these books. She's talking about 12 words and how it's going to change everybody's lives in all these different countries. And I just think those types of stories for us, those are simple things. We're like, of course we know about, you know, not your keys, not your coins. Of course we understand self-custody, but a lot of people don't. And I think putting those features of Bitcoin into some sort of context that someone like that understands sort of intuitively. I'll give you another example. They actually told me a story about, but you know, just like, you know, in their later years, kids in college or, you know, at that age and their water got cut off and they were like, what happened? Like the water's not coming out of the faucet. And they call the utilities company, again, very senior elected official. Oh, they found out your expiration date on your credit card, your credit card expired. And it was 2 days before they could get water turned back on. There was a fee for turn on fee. And so, I told her, like, I think that's a great example of something like Lightning Network would be very beneficial. We don't have expiration dates. We don't have, all these type of, issues to overcome in order for someone to be able to get water. And especially when, I can pay for it. A credit card expires and suddenly 48 hours of hell. Now, that's in the United States for a senior ranking elected official. And the conversation shifted to that's a minor inconvenience for us. For me, my water turns off today. It's an inconvenience. I get pissed off. I call somebody, chew them out or whatever and fix the issue. For some people in the world, that could actually be a life or death situation. And I think we're seeing, that's just a really small example of a lot of things that we've seen and we'll see more of as the systems and tectonic plates that hold all this thing up are really beginning to shift and to bump into one another.
No, I mean, I think that those are both really, really good stories. And, honestly, it's those kind of human stories around Bitcoin that I feel like elected representatives, they need to hear if there's even a chance of them, being aligned with this thing. Because as long as there's confusion, FUD can move the needle. But if they kind of understand what's happening here, they know that there's consequences to them banishing something that's more than a quote unquote like Ponzi scheme or whatever. Right.
I'll give you one more.
Hey, I also want to keep us on time too. So we got a lot of things to talk about in terms of, BPI. Yeah. But hit me with another story. Yeah. Let's do it.
Yeah. One more. I'll just say, I was talking with a staffer about Lightning and trying to explain, why it's such a, such cool technology, why it's going to really shake things up, why it's important. With an eye towards some regulatory issues that I know a lot of companies are facing. And the guy just kind of looked at me like, he's not quite getting it, not quite clicking. And I said, well, listen, let's talk about credit card fees. Most credit card fees, everyone here knows it's about 3% every time you do a transaction, give or take, whatever, but it's around 3%. And I kind of started talking about that. And he was looking at me kind of weird. And he said, so actually, I think I know exactly what you're talking about. Our team went to, a lot of the staffers, they go out into the, all over the state or all over the, the district, and they visit constituents, they drop in, they have all their favorite spots because they're there regularly. They probably were there during the campaign season as well, because people who work on the campaigns are normally the people who end up working in the offices. And so they have their haunts. They stop at, some rural restaurant diner that they always go to, and they get ready to pay for their whole staff, which is probably, 5 to 10 different people. And they're like, wait, what do you mean you don't accept cards? And they're like, yeah, we're, a few months ago we went cash only. And they're like, why would you do that? Doesn't that hurt your business? And they're like, no. In fact, credit card fees were about to put us out of business. And I know, most restaurants that we go to, no way they're operating on a 3% margin, that like really a 3% is a matter of life or death. And that may not be true, but where I'm from out in the middle of nowhere, man. And a lot of these mom pop restaurants, 3% is the difference in them keeping the lights on or them going out of business and just doing something else. And so he intuitively understood, like, so you're telling me that someone like that, the Lightning Network, can help them stay in business and accept electronic payments, whereas the current system could literally force them out of business. I'm like, That's exactly what I'm telling you. That's what I've been trying to tell you. But it takes those real life stories of real people that they can connect to. It's just like anyone, you know, we overcomplicate this sometimes. So it's like, how do we orange pill DC the same way as you and I? It just has to put a human face on it. And that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, I think one thing before we move on to the next subject is like, what's like the pillar thesis at BPI? Because I think that that's something that's important, because I think when Bitcoiners hear about what the thesis is and, you know, what elements of Bitcoin, you know, you are educating people about, they're going to be really excited about, you know, the work you're doing.
Right. Well, I appreciate you bringing it home. Yeah. Essentially, our goal at Bitcoin Policy Institute is to demonstrate that Bitcoin is good for America. We want to show that it's good for America from a national security standpoint, that it's good from an environmental and energy standpoint, that it's good in a future of money standpoint. And we want to demonstrate the value long-term, the strategic value of Bitcoin to the United States as a nation state, to sort of bring it down a level. The conversation I recently had, I love anecdotes, if you can't tell. I was kind of talking with some friends, you know, elected official staffers here locally. And I said, you guys don't realize, but what's happening over here at Bitcoin Park right now, the caliber of people, the founders, the developers, the giga brains that are over there right now discussing the future of Bitcoin and what they're building, the companies, this is like the early days of Silicon Valley, where they're, you know, building computers in a garage somewhere and no one even knows it. So the potential is astronomical. And we're trying to go to DC and through all these different means and methods, really build the case that not only is Bitcoin good, not only is Bitcoin going to, you know, change the world, but that we need to embrace it. And that we don't want to be left behind. We do not want to be left behind. And you see other countries like China banning Bitcoin mining. And we saw how that worked out. Mm-hmm. Bitcoin mining didn't care. They just moved over here. And, you know, their loss, our gain.
What's BPI's perspective on self-custody and running a node?
Oh, yeah. I think one, we encourage self-custody. We encourage people to run nodes. Of course, we think that's like within our rights as United States citizens to, we should be able to self-custody our own Bitcoin. That's a given. Anyone who doesn't think that, I would have some, one, maybe they need some education around what that means and what self-custody is. I think it's pretty intuitive to understand that. And obviously we need have the right to run nodes. That's boilerplate stuff for us.
Yeah. I mean, no, I just think it's important. It's boilerplate stuff, but, you know, there's all these organizations out there that, you know, are representing Bitcoin and all this other stuff. And, you know, it almost like they lose sight of what's important in, you know, protecting the core, you know, tenets of Bitcoin, which is, you know, verifying yourself, holding it yourself. And obviously the permissionlessness of proof of work mining and all the, you know, downstream benefits of that, you know, that's really the focus.
Right, right. Well, there's a lot of people doing a lot of things. You know, I'm sure there's some people doing great things. There's some people not so great things. But as far as Bitcoin Policy Institute is concerned, we focus on Bitcoin and Bitcoin only. We occasionally do work talking about potential impacts of something like the CBDC. One of our fellows who's a legal expert, Zach Shapiro, recently, you know, put out some comment just to sort of help people understand the context of the lawsuit between the SEC and Ripple. But that's as far as we touch anything not Bitcoin related. It's more just helping others to sort of understand the context and implications mm-hmm. of some of those events.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. So, Stephen, you know, obviously, a big part of your role, you know, you talked about what David and Grant do a lot and, you know, the conversations you've had, but a big part of your role is making sure that BPI is sustainable, right? Like this work, you know, obviously requires, you know, employees and dedicated folks full time, and they need funding. You know, can you just talk about you joined this team in a time where it was kind of life or death in terms of being able to be sustainable and doing this work for the Bitcoin industry? And, you know, what that experience was kind of like getting it to this point where, you know, you're adding rock star fellows who, you know, are professors at Ivy League institutions to write about money in Bitcoin.
Sure. Yeah. You know, Grant David launched BPI, right before a pretty brutal bear market. And so, like any organization, really any company, we definitely feel the impact of that. And, I actually joined, BPI not too long before, the FTX collapse. And so, it was a really interesting few months for everyone, right? So I don't think we're alone in that. Obviously, the goal of any nonprofit, you want long-term sustainability. As a nonprofit, we rely on outside funding. We rely on businesses. We rely on individuals that are generous and believe in our work and believe that, we're putting lead on steel, that we're achieving our mission and that our mission's important. And so fortunately, there's a lot of people who see the value. There's a lot of businesses that look at our work and look at our research and the way that we deliver our research, and they're very impressed. I'm impressed. I don't do the research, but I read all of it, and I'm like, man, like I'm grateful. And this is part of the reason I was attracted to BPI in the first place, was like, I've seen a lot of this. I've seen a lot of the think tanks and groups that are doing all, you know, and so much of it, not all of it, so much of it is superfluous. And it's just, I don't want to be too derogatory, but you get where I'm going with it. And no, I look at BPI, and I looked at our fellows and I read some of the work, and I'm like, one, nobody's doing this. Nobody else is doing what BPI is doing. And I said this, you know, CK, you and I talked about this before I was ever on board. I was like, man, these guys are doing phenomenal work. And
no, it was no undeniable, honestly. It's shocking that people weren't just, you know, giving the money just based on, you know, what they were doing even from day one. But obviously it's not that easy.
Well, I think a mistake people make when they look at nonprofits is you look at the product, right? In our product, we have 15 fellows producing unbelievable research. We just brought on, you mentioned a new fellow, we just brought on Sarah Krebs. She's a Cornell professor. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She's unbelievably brilliant and talented. And you look at someone like her, or you look at our fellows like Troy Cross or Matt Pines, I could go down the list. They're all amazing. And you're like, man, I guess these guys are cruising. They have all these connections. They're in DC. They're, you know, meeting with all these like high up officials. And we just sort of are like, you know, we kind of caught lightning in a bottle. We said, I keep saying we, I mean, a lot of the work was done. Foundation was laid before I was ever around, but David and Grant, they just hustled. You know, there's no easy button to recruiting, you know, academics that are leading experts in their field. There's no easy button to writing 100 pages on Bitcoin and national security. You just either do it or you don't. And so, people look and they're like, well, you guys are crushing it. I mean, they must be doing, you know, they must be flush with cash. And the truth is, like, we just grind, you know, and we grind every day. And I'm a big sports fan. I read all the documentaries. There's like the F1 series now. There's the quarterback series on Netflix. And my favorite quarterback, I'm a Chiefs fan, is Patrick Mahomes. I mean, he's the man. I've been a Chiefs fan since I was an infant. But they all say, like, let's get 1% better every day. And that's what we try to do, is like, let's be 1% more effective every day at what we do. to be 1% more effective at our research, 1%, especially more effective at our DC advocacy. But I think if I had an ask, it would just be like, I can rattle off paper after paper that we're either just put out or that we have queued up, you know, assessing the externalities of Bitcoin mining. Margo and Troy are working on a climate paper right now. Josh Hendrickson, phenomenal guy, just a good guy. And in addition to being brilliant, a paper on how mining bans will backfire. We have our national security program that we're dumping a ton of time and energy into. The one thing we can't just write into existence, the one thing we can't just will into existence by going to DC is funding. We just rely on people who look at us, look at our work. Don't look at me, look at our work and say like, yeah, this has to continue. And there's people that are doing that and that are writing checks. We need more of it. We don't need an unlimited budget, but we could use, I can promise you, we could double or triple our output if we had the right resources. We're doing great, but we could double or triple our output if we had the resources necessary.
Yeah, I mean, and granted, you're doing great now. That wasn't always the case. You know, you didn't want to go too much into it, but, there was some time where, you know, it was month to month. Is this going to be able to continue? And obviously, you know, the value that you've been able to create has really demonstrated why BPI needs to be sustainable. And that's why BPI is sustainable right now. And it's really exciting, you know, to see now what you all at BPI are able to do once, you know, you have a solid foundation to build off of. And Sarah Krebs, she's obviously a massive get. I don't think many Bitcoiners really understand how big of a get that is to be on effectively Team Bitcoin to try to articulate why this technology is important. And, you know, that's just the beginning, right? So the more that BPI is able to, you know, take industry dollars, take independent donations, the more that BPI can continue to build Bitcoin's momentum. Because ultimately, you know, if you live in the US, you want this protected for you. But if you live outside of the US, BPI is also a model for what you can do in your country. So we already see Bitcoin Policy UK emerge, you know, undoubtedly inspired by the work you are doing. And, you know, more of these will emerge as, you know, people continue to advocate within their own realm why Bitcoin is good for them. Because here's the key, and I'll get off my tirade and pass it back to you, Stephen. Bitcoin is anti-fragile. This is something I realized. Bitcoin's anti-fragile. Bitcoin is designed to last this test of time. Bitcoiners, us, we're the fragile ones. We're the ones who need advocating for. The work you're doing is for the Bitcoiners, not necessarily Bitcoin. Obviously, everything is good for Bitcoin, but you know that's what's important. And we want 1,000 of these organizations protecting Bitcoiners and Bitcoin advocates and Bitcoin users in every nation. So that's why I think it's so important. But you know, Stephen, back to the work you're doing. You know, what's next? What can people get excited for about BPI? And you know, why should they be thrilled about, you know, investing in Bitcoin by investing in this kind of work?
Well, yeah, we're obviously really careful to say we don't represent Bitcoin in any capacity, and we don't represent Bitcoiners. We represent like I said, our goal of showing and proving to the United States that Bitcoin's a good idea for them, and that it is in our own best interest to, like you said, protect Bitcoiners and protect our rights as U.S. citizens. And hopefully, you know, as a leader in the free world, those rights carry over into flourishing in other countries as well. So that's the goal. But yeah, I would just say, as far as the future, I rattle off a lot of work that's in queue right now. I think the big thing that a lot of people are excited about is our national security program. You know, there, if you go back and you kind of thumb through our website, which we're in the process of updating right now, there's some really compelling research about China's goals in Africa via the Belt and Road Initiative. Just to sort of, you know, do a very high level summary. If you're not familiar with the Belt and Road Initiative, China's moving through Africa, building infrastructure and saying, hey, let's make a deal. I'll build infrastructure in or through your country. And they're like, all right, what's the catch? They're like, the catch is we'll pay you to let us do it. They're like, are you serious? You'll pay us to let you build infrastructure? And they're like, yeah. They're like, all right. They're like, and so, you know, here it is. Here's your digital yuan, which is obviously a tool of the surveillance state. So they're spreading their own CBDC throughout the world. And as the United States, we have a question we have to ask is, what do we do about it? Well, we kind of have two options. And we have a few different options, but let's just filter them down to two for the next, you know, we have about 5 minutes left on this podcast. One option is we can bring our own CBDC and we can start throwing around ourselves. So in the words of Matt Pines, we could try to out China China. And for a number of reasons, one, China's better at being a surveillance state and they're better at being China than we are. Some listeners may disagree with that, but they're China's always going to be better at being China. So we can out China China, or we could use we could build some freedom firewalls, which is, I just made that term up, but we could basically install Bitcoin. We could give Bitcoin or, you know, use Bitcoin in different countries or in different areas, different regions as firewalls of freedom. So when China comes through, tries to install their CBDC, these countries are like, I'm good. And actually we've seen this play out in that region. We have proof of concept that works. And so it's more than just that story, but a full deep dive into a lot of those dynamics. You can go on our website, go under national security and read it. We're going to take that. We're going to run with it to the nth degree. And there are a lot of really, really interesting things queued up for the rest of this year.
Well, I mean, hey, I think freedom firewall is super important. You know, ultimately, the idea that the U.S. should make its own CBDC, I definitely don't think that that's the way. Right. I think Bitcoin is the money that has American values built into it. And when you look at how Bitcoin is distributed, it's just distributed through mining, and mining has a whole host of benefits for, you know, countries in Africa that need infrastructure to be built, need a buyer for that electricity infrastructure that, you know, that comes before, you know, people are ready to accept that electricity. So there's
buyer organization, first resort, buyer last resort, right?
Yeah. I mean, and that's a tough concept for people to understand. I think Brandon Quidham said Bitcoin mining is everything you don't know about Bitcoin mixed with everything you don't know about the energy grid. But, you know, ultimately, yeah, when you actually understand what's happening there, it's pretty obvious that Bitcoin is this ingenious solution to, you know, install freedom, firewall freedom, as well as to help these nations advance in a way that's much more natural and beneficiary than the Belt and Road top-down initiative that's happening there. So, hey, I know that you have a hard stop, Stephen. You know, I want to give you the last word here. You know, what's your call to action to the Bitcoin Magazine audience listening to this?
Yeah, well, I'd say there's a couple of things. One, everybody says, and you've heard this a million times, like call your congressman, call your elected officials, and you can probably roll your eyes. I mean, I know I did for a long time, but that stuff actually matters. And I know, you know, we're sort of zero or one with our elected officials. We either think they're the best ever, or we think they're cronies that are useless and they, you know, their only goal is to like destroy everything we love. Well, I'm sure there are people like that. But my experience, they really give a damn what you think for whatever reason. But call them, like talk to them about this and talk to them about Bitcoin and why you think it's important. Read some of our work, talk to them about that. So I think that actually is a really important thing, especially at scale. The more voices we hear, we're like, whoa, you know, and even if you don't like them, even if they don't, even if they say they don't like Bitcoin, there's something to be said for realizing, like, man, I'll mess with a lot of people, but I'm not going to mess with those Bitcoiners. There's a lot of them, and they're really fired up. I think that's important. On the other side, for as far as BPI is concerned, I personally, if you're listening to this and you're, you know, you want to have a conversation, maybe I'm wrong about everything, you want to correct me, I'm always open to taking meetings and you know, collaborating and having a conversation with someone. So feel free to reach out on Twitter. And third, you know, we circle back to it. I'm not trying to pitch everybody, but we could use your help. We have a big, fat, shiny donate button on our website. And we are in the process this fall. We're trying to build up our monthly recurring donation base through our campaign. And CK, we should have put this at the beginning, but you know, I wanted people to kind of know more about us before I told them. But we have a campaign this fall starting next month, and we're going to be focusing exclusively on or intensely on building up that monthly recurring donations. That's what we really need. That helps us know and helps us to be able to project out what we can afford to do as far as research or bring on fellows or, you know, doing different events, which is super mm-hmm. important. We mm-hmm. have to be able to do more of that, especially in DC. It's unbelievably expensive to go up there and do an event, but we have to do it. And so, you know, the plebs, you guys band together. I know you guys could help us out. And if anyone is interested in making a significant donation, we accept those too.
All right. Well, hey, Steven, I appreciate you kind of telling people about that campaign. I know that, you know, for me, if that's something that I want to put my name on, I can write it off. And, you know, I already donate to some nonprofits, so I can't think of a better place to, you know, point that tax deductible, you know, investment I'm already making than BPI. So I'm down to join that cause. But to all the listeners, really encourage you to check out btcpolicy.org. A lot of great stuff there. And, you know, and at the least, look at the research, because often that is one of the most serious pieces of content that you can give to someone who wants to learn more about Bitcoin. Ultimately, you know, sometimes Bitcoin magazine articles aren't necessarily the right tone. They're more geared towards Bitcoiners who want to continue thinking about Bitcoin. So BPI and the BTC policy.org is a really great resource out there. You know, and if you enjoy what they do, consider donating. But with that, y'all can find me at Bitcoin Amsterdam. That is October 12th through the 13th. So I'm excited to shake all of your hands there. And we are officially within a year of Bitcoin 2024 in Nashville. Steven and I will both be there for sure. So come shake our hands in Nashville. Thousands of Bitcoiners have already pre-purchased tickets. And you can still get your Amsterdam and Bitcoin 24 ticket bundled for very, very cheap. Cheaper than the shows that are just later this year. So it's definitely the best deal on the market for the best events of the year. And with that,
thank you, Miami, for the last 3 years in this amazing city. The whole world shut down, but Miami welcomed us with open arms. We want to show Bitcoin to the whole world. We are taking the conference on the road to set the stage for Bitcoin in a new city. Nashville. Bitcoin 2024 is coming to Nashville in Tennessee, a city that is known as a music and freedom city. Bitcoin 2024 in Nashville from July 25th to 27th.